Thank you very much, Francis. Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. And I would like to spend the next 40 minutes or so talking about gatekeeping and digital media. What gatekeeping is, so who does it, how's it done, who's affected, what impact does gatekeeping have, gatekeeping at different levels of organisations and societies, and what does it mean for media policy, and what actions are needed to keep it under control. But perhaps we should start at the beginning with the whole term gatekeeping. It exists in English and exists in a number of languages, including Putonghua. What I wanted to start with is one of the things that I was thinking about on my summer holidays when I was asked to write about this particular topic by George Soros' foundation, the Open Society Institute. In fact, in most parts of the world, we do in fact understand this metaphor because we can relate to something from our own culture. So in this particular case, it's a walled city in the Middle Ages from somewhere in Europe. And what we're looking at is down here, the small the gate, the principal gate to the city. Don't you worry, there'll be some more images later on. I think that's why. Okay. And if we go to South America, the Incas had Machu Picchu, and in fact, to get into it, there was a gate. And so Machu Picchu, is in Peru, and it's in the southern part of Peru. And there we've got the gate itself, built without mortar. A bit nearer home, in the mainland, walled cities were quite common. This is the gate, which today is in the middle of a very big roundabout, but you can still get a clear idea of what it must have been like at the time. And there are some fascinating parallels between European and Chinese walled cities. So these were places where there was some degree of control over who came in and came out. So at night time, these would tend to be closed, or if there was illness or if there was war. So these places were closed off. But interestingly, on the inside and the outside of gates, they were typically central points of information. So certainly in Europe, this is where you had information about weights and measures, about other information of general interest to not just to the merchants but also to the peasants if they could read. The metaphor of a walled city and a gate actually already tells us quite a lot. It contains some connotations we can quite easily build on in the context of something like media. So there's the entrance to the walled city. What we're going to be looking at is some of the gatekeeping mechanisms. Certainly in Europe, that you would have something that could descend a portcullis, so you could simply lower that to keep people out if there was suddenly an attack. Or in the case of this model of a castle, you've just got a drawbridge. You could simply lift up the bridge and then you had a surrounding moat or something of that kind. So it was the main mechanism for regulating the entrance and exit of people and goods and animals. So the central questions we need to look at is, where are there gates? Is it just one gate or is there more than one gate? Who's the gatekeeper? So who's, in this particular case, it's a model. So you've got a Lego creature there which is actually holding something or other. And who are the gated? We can say the people, the objects of that particular control. And how does it all work? So the terms that I suggest we use for this, the gate is the point at which passage is controlled. The second thing is gaping. It's the process of controlling passage. Then we've got a gatekeeper. He's the actor or stakeholder that performs gatekeeping. The gated, that's the person or the entity on whom gatekeeping is exercised. And finally, the gatekeeping mechanism is the means used to carry out gatekeeping. Looks a no-brainer, something that everybody should understand. But the reality is it's slightly more complicated than that. So that's why I would like to look at some examples with you. So I'll just run through something that, because something like Now TV and free-to-air digital TV in Hong Kong, because most of you will know about Now TV at least. Something like American Idol, where it begins to get slightly less familiar what's actually involved in something like that. And then perhaps for many of you, a rather surprising example, how can a consumer electronics manufacturer like Samsung suddenly become a gatekeeper? And I'll just take you through that particular example, and then we'll have a look at WikiLeaks, because I think that's a good example to show how different kinds of control are exercised by different stakeholders and what happens in spite of all of that. So let's have a look at a food chain or a value chain, and we'll just start at the beginning. So if you look at making any kind of media, you begin with some sources. So if it's a news program, in the case of WikiLeaks, you've got 250,000 cables, many of which have been acquired without the owner's knowledge from various sources. So you've got sources who've actually done this, you've got information, and you've also got rights. So, for example, if you want to do something about the Olympic Games or the 2018 or the 2022 World Cup in Moscow or Qatar, you can't just do the media coverage. No, you have to ink a deal with FIFA. And because this is a billion-dollar industry, so access to things like events depend very much on having an agreement with the rights holders. So the first stage is you've got to make something, you've got to package it as television channels, you've got to put it together as some sort of offering, so not just one channel but a number of channels. Deliver it by cable or satellite or through the ether if you still use terrestrial transmission. And at the other end, you need some sort of device to actually receive it on. And of course, you've got the viewer, probably the most important stakeholder in this context. So that's for television, but we're going to be using a similar value chain for a number of different kinds of digital media. So if we look at an organization like Now TV and compare it with free TV, which is available not just analog but from 2012 in digital form only in Hong Kong, you can already receive a number of channels. What's the difference in the proposition there? Okay, if we look at Now TV, it's Now TV, which is a PCCW subsidiary, which essentially, as the operator, decides what packages they want to offer and how much they want to charge. So, in the pay TV business, you're not on your own. There will be other competitors, and there have been in the past. Although Now TV seems to be one of the biggest operators in Hong Kong. So clearly the operator has some degree of control over what channels are made available. But at the same time, they don't just let you go out and buy a TV set. They have a specific box which is built to their requirements, which allows you to see their signals which are delivered as a kind of IPTV, so it uses the internet protocol to deliver the signal. So both in terms of being an operator but in terms of of the hardware, they're defining what it is you need to use. And you can say, why did they do that? Well, if you actually build something which is proprietary, and you have an interesting user proposition, the channels you have are attractive. You've got something to attract people to get them to watch your offerings, but at the same time, if you actually have to invest in a, not just a TV set but a set-top box, and it only works with Now TV, if you decide that you want something else, then you've got to go out and invest in a new box. Let's compare that proposition with free-to-air TV. Okay, you haven't got very much choice. So in Hong Kong, you don't anyway. You have a very limited number of channels. Some people don't watch much TV anyway, and if they do, they watch it more on their computers. But say you're okay with just a limited number of channels. Well, the proposition here is that you can go out and buy anything which has got the appropriate badge on it or label from the government indicating whether it complies with the basic receiver or more advanced receiver for handling standard definition or HD. And so here there isn't a gatekeeper in that sense. If you decide to buy a new TV set, you can go out and buy a new TV set, and there's nothing to stop you doing just that. So from that perspective, free-to-air is a fairly transparent option. You just go down to Fortress or one of the other consumer electronics retailers and buy some stuff and plug in a connection and you're up and running, hopefully, unless Murphy has been interfering with you. But I asked at the beginning, is there just one gate? Remember, the photographs I showed were typically of a walled gate, a walled city which had one main gate. What we're talking about here is the fact that there may in fact be gates, whether these are visible or not, at a number of different places throughout the food chain or the value chain. And we'll look at some of them. I don't want to keep you here all night, so there's an article which you can take with you, which is about gatekeeping in connection with news. And later this week or early next, there'll be another more extensive article available online from the Open Society Institute about this topic, because it was agreed on yesterday. So we can say not just at the whole value level, the value chain level, but if we look at just the production part, we have in fact a number of different points where some sort of control is exercised. Some of these, if you're in journalism, they're fairly clear. I mean, if you're a TV journalist and you've got a research assistant, you take part in an editorial meeting typically in the morning, a briefing where various tasks are assigned, and you go out. And then you make use of your sources and you go out with your electronic news gathering team. And there will be a number of conscious and sometimes subconscious decisions about what to do and what not to do. Some of these will be to do with the news itself. It could also be in terms of how you want to get the story across. During the editing process, there can be changes. There are other people involved at a later stage, and ultimately, you may actually have produced a really great story, only to discover that everything is being clear because they want to talk about WikiLeaks. So all that work has gone into doing something, a labor of love, and it's trashed, or it actually may make it online, or it may make it tomorrow. So there are points at which even within a production team that some kinds of controls are made. And generally speaking, we've got about 45 to 50 years of research on this, so that's pretty well documented. But if we look at something like American Idol, the influences, the stakeholders, and how they actually interact with each other, and where there actually are gates affecting what we see and what we can do may not be quite so clear. So American Idol is probably the most valuable property of the moment still on the American TV market. So it's still the show that commands the highest advertising rates. And the revenue streams are not just advertising. There's significant revenue from the sponsors, and they're up here, Ford, Coca-Cola, and AT&T. And even 6 years after they started doing this, there's significant revenues from the voting. You use premium-rated SMS text messages. And in 2004, more people voted on American Idol than they did for their president. So it's an indication of what people find important in different societies, how people choose to spend their time. What I wanted to do is just to take you through a value network. So just look at where is value created, but also where does the money come from? So up front, we've got the four main sets of stakeholders. We've got the advertisers, of course. We've got Simon Fuller, who's the guy who actually created the format Pop Idol, which has actually spawned a number of versions. In fact, Pop Idol that was actually tested in the States and really flopped. So it was only because of Murdoch's daughter that it actually got another chance on Fox TV. Then there's a production company actually doing the television production. In the last season, AT&T, Coca-Cola and Ford are sponsors because of the nature of the show. The show is fairly harmless. It's a sort of a family thing shown, I think, on Thursday nights. And therefore, it's a good match with the brand images of certainly Ford, but also Coca-Cola. AT&T's interests are slightly different. They've been in there as a sponsor because they wanted to push the whole idea of using SMS voting. So they had some other interests. So we've got people actually producing the stuff. We've got Fox, who actually aggregates the programs into channels. And if we're looking at if it's being shown on in Asia on Star TV, that would be uplinked by the operator to some sort of satellite provider, and then will be seen either directly through a satellite dish or through redistribution SMATV locally, even in Hong Kong. So that's where the value is created. So you starts off with a format holder from Simon Fuller, but of course ultimately the view ends up paying for all of this, and so some of the viewing is through voting. The viewers vote, and they're paying a premium rate for doing so. That goes back to the broadcaster, and perhaps there's a revenue split with a production company. I'm not sure in this particular case. And money goes back to the rights holder, of course. Money goes from the viewer to in the form of subscriptions to the satellite operator. Money goes indirectly to the sponsors. They're in it because they're altruistic. They're actually there to make sure their brand gets exposed along with a fairly healthy brand, American Idol. So it's in their interest to be associated with a brand that links well with their product. So indirectly, it must make sense to have their name mentioned. And of course, that's why they pay Fox for the right to be sponsors. Then we've got advertisers, and of course they're paying either the satellite operator or the broadcaster or both for time. So advertise in the channels themselves, but there may be some additional ads running on the platform itself. So you may be wondering, why have I color-coded things? Well, if you look at the sponsors, there's some overlap between the interests of AT&T. They want to make sure its voting takes place in that particular way. There are other ways of doing voting, but they wouldn't necessarily be of particular interest to AT&T. So if the concept changed, if the format changed, maybe AT&T wouldn't be so interested. Advertisers, of course, are interested. Ford actually advertises its products as well. Coca-Cola, in the US at least, has the Coca-Cola room, where you can see a red room with people drinking Coke when the judges are actually discussing what's happening. And the yellow boxes, they're all organizations owned by Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, which is in fact an extremely well-run organization, one which I think in many ways I quite admire. Certainly Sky is one of the best-run operations in Europe. So what I'm doing here is just talking you through how these things are related. So value is created, but this is paid for in a number of ways with which you may not be familiar. So it's not just your subscription fee to the operator. It's you're paying something if you're voting. You're indirectly paying something through the products you do something with on with the sponsors, and of course advertising. So it's not always quite clear what commercial relationships there are in place and whether these have an impact on what actually happens in digital media of that kind. And let's take another example. That's the one of widgets. These are small kind of pop-up windows which appear on televisions. An example of it is can be seen here. You've got widgets. For example, with you've got weather widgets, you've got news widgets here. And so these are always on your screen when you buy a Samsung product, which is internet-enabled. Well, what's wrong with that? Well, superficially, nothing at all. But what they haven't, you may not have realized, is that you can't necessarily change Yahoo. You're stuck with Yahoo. If you happen to be watching in Europe, BBC News, BBC World, or if you're watching Sky and you watch Sky News, the widget doesn't change to BBC's widget or to Sky's widget. No, it stays as Yahoo. And this business of actually hardwiring content provisions which are overlaid a television signal have been a source of concern for a couple of years, simply because it isn't necessarily very clear, very transparent what's actually going on. Is there in fact an exclusive deal between Samsung and Yahoo? We have to guess that. We have to surmise that, but we don't actually know. Why is it not possible to change it? Do people, when they buy TV sets, realize that when they've bought an internet-enabled TV, indirectly some of the cost of this could in fact be subsidized by the people who want to actually offer services? I mean, Flickr isn't necessarily a paid-for service, but you've got Yahoo's finance over here. So there are clearly some stakeholders here who have a relationship with, in this particular case, the consumer electronics manufacturer. So here is where Samsung is actually involved, and we would normally assume, if we just go out and buy a Samsung TV to watch free-to-air TV, there's no particular issue to do with that. Well, there may be, and an issue is was brought home to me when I was wandering around northern Portugal in July. This is Guimarães, which is where the cradle of the nation. This is where Portugal was born. And I was walking around and I suddenly realized that here, bricked in at the moment, was in fact a sort of a hidden gate, sort of a back door where you could actually get out if you wanted to. And this was, at the time, it had been behind a tree, so you wouldn't have realized it. So I think in some ways, the Yahoo Samsung arrangement is a little bit like a concealed gate. And the issue isn't that there is that relationship, but it's because the relationship isn't self-evident and people aren't necessarily aware of it when they actually buy a device. Now, what I've done is to take the same drawing and I've just changed it to WikiLeaks. So we've got the WikiLeaks portal, the domain name, hosts, ISPs, e-payment, and computer. So down the bottom, we've got WikiLeaks, DNS.com, where the people who actually provide you with there's the name server which actually handles the IDs. You've got Amazon, who until a week ago was their contractor who actually provided them with the hosting, who were replaced by a French company for a few days, who then had difficulties with their Minister of Communications. You've got Visa and PayPal, who are handling e-payments, and these are for contributions to WikiLeaks. And then you've got things like national firewalls. You've got, for example, in China, the now ill-fated Green Dam mechanism for actually trying to filter things. So the WikiLeaks example is an interesting one, because what we're seeing is an attempt to either openly or less openly say WikiLeaks shouldn't actually be online. So it's interesting, you know, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So DNS.com was saying, of course we would like to do this, but we're receiving so much flak. There are so many attacks, malicious attacks. We're worried not just about WikiLeaks. We're worried about hundreds upon hundreds, if not thousands, of our clients if it's going to roll over. So that was the argument. Amazon and OVH came up with fairly nebulous arguments for why they didn't feel happy about continuing to operate, offer their services. The same goes for Visa and PayPal. Just to give you an idea of how much has changed in a week, well, I've only checked it yesterday. I haven't checked it today. So a week ago, on December 1st, we had one website called WikiLeaks.org. When we checked it yesterday, there were around 507 servers, mirror servers. That's why I've chosen the mirror. So there's the original server down here, but there's now 507 mirrors of the original server in a number of different countries. They're not working all of the time, but it's a bit like Mark Twain saying you can fool some of the people all of the time and all of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all of the people all of the time. What WikiLeaks is demonstrating is that you can close down some of the servers all of the time and all of the servers for a short period of time, but you can't keep all of these servers off the internet indefinitely. So this particular mechanism being reinforced as it is through Twitter actually enables WikiLeaks to actually keep operating. So in spite of having this lack of transparency, in spite of people saying one thing and perhaps doing something else, a fairly contentious portal which continues to leak cables is still in business, at least for the time being. And Visa and PayPal talk about their reasons for not being able to do this, which may well be legitimate. So what impact does gatekeeping have? Well, I've tried to intimate what it has. I've taken some sticky Danish pastries. So the first thing is actually trying to be just that sticky. If you're a supplier, if you're Now TV, or if you're Sky, or if you're a mobile phone operator like Three, your interest is not just getting customers but keeping them. And to keep your customers, you have to have something which is sticky. So both have got to be attractive, but preferably if you can put together some sort of exit barriers, something that makes it quite inconvenient or expensive or both to leave that service, that can be quite a good idea. An example from the UK, Sky, also a Murdoch company, used to have a churn rate, as to say, about 1 in 10 of its customers cancelled their subscriptions for satellite TV per year, which is quite a good figure. But it's quite expensive as the market matures if you've got to change a tenth of your customers every year. So, okay, some admin, but there's lots of other knock-on costs. So they developed what still seems to be one of the best personal video recorders, PVRs, a device for actually seeing TV when you want to, rather than just using the internet. The launch of that particular device was very attractive. Initially, it cost about HK$120 a month to have that service. But the interesting thing was that they cancelled the charge. They had to buy the box simply because it brought down churn to somewhere around 2 to 3%. And I don't know anybody who's got churn rates as low as that. This was really a sticky proposition. People really liked their products. The PVRs that they launched were among the most attractive and enjoyed consumer items that have ever been seen on the market. So you want to make it sticky, you want to make the cost of switching supplier costly. So by all means, if you're a pay TV operator or a mobile phone operator, you can actually make things more expensive by, if you're allowed to do so legally, some tying people in for a period of, say, 6 months or 12 months to a particular plan, during which they would then forfeit the whole of the subscription if they actually chose to change providers. In the case of mobile phones, there is in fact a lock, so you can actually lock something for the first period if you want to. The other challenge seems to be, from the user's perspective, that things are pretty opaque. That is to say, even if you actually spend some time, it's quite difficult to interpret what's going on. Here's somebody looking, somebody looking at an X-ray. But by the same token, imagine you were just trying to work out what was going on in that example of Yahoo and Samsung. Most people wouldn't have the wherewithal to find out what was going on, why there was a problem. So in some respects, media creation and media distribution is quite opaque. And when things are opaque, somewhat murky, then there's more chance for dirty deals to take place. It doesn't mean that they will do, but if things are not clear, then there is a decided risk that may actually happen. So what does this mean for media policy? Well, in a number of fields, in particular in trade, we talk about the level playing field. I was trying to find an illustration. This is claimed to be a playing field in a stadium in Malaysia, but I think it's just a neat bit of photoshopping work, image manipulation. I think conventional broadcasters, tend to think they have an uphill task when they're delivering services compared with those who deliver, say, video via the internet. Simply because the regulators, the way in which we regulate things reflect the world as it was 10 or 20 years ago. So ideally, in a world where we have the opportunity to deliver just about anything on any network, but the networks just know that from a technical perspective, it's a binary code, zeros and ones. So essentially, with the bandwidth we have these days, whether we use that for lots of text or quite a lot of voice or more limited amounts of video and audio is completely immaterial. And that means that having certain networks which are highly regulated and other networks which are not at all regulated or hardly regulated isn't really conducive to having a level playing field if you want people to actually compete on fair terms. So I think convergence, the fact that we're moving in that sort of direction, requires technology agnostic regulation. And we do have regulators who recognise that. Singapore was one of the first. But it's still the case in most industrialised countries that regulation is about 10 or 20 years behind. Mind you, things like intellectual property, that's probably a century behind. I mean, we're clearing rights to media, and essentially they could be sitting there with a ledger and a quill pen or a brush, actually doing very elegant characters in a ledger, because we haven't really changed the way in which we handle intellectual property when it comes to media. We're still in the 19th century as far as the administration of rights is concerned. In the 20th century in terms of regulation, and in the 21st century is what we and our kids are actually seeing. So the need for a more pragmatic and more realistic basis for regulation. The second thing is a need for greater transparency, and some examples here. Apple has been very successful in putting together an app store. It's got just about everything right. And the result of that is it's suffering, because there's probably about 270,000 apps all competing for eyeballs. And just organizing information about 270,000 products is in itself a daunting task. So increasingly, it's not enough just to be on the App Store. You need some sort of viral marketing or some other kind of buzz to get the attention of your potential consumers. The other thing is that Apple's got fairly clear guidelines. They take a 30% margin for actually looking at your product, giving it a technical test to make sure that it runs without crashing, and which is part of the Apple ethos. You pay them more money, and they're selling you peace of mind. They're giving you some technology that works, easy to use, but of course you pay them a bit more money. If we look at the Android situation, there's no mechanism for actually controlling apps. You can upload things and sell them through the Android App Store, or you can sell them directly. The tricky thing there is that the owner of Android is Google, and Google has a substantial share of the world's advertising revenues. And therefore, it's very difficult to know if there are any visible or invisible links between what gets promoted and what doesn't get promoted. So there have been some test cases. There was a potential case with the App Store where a third party had complained to the Federal Communications Commission in the States about apparently antitrust behavior, and that's to say anti-competitive behavior on the part of Apple. But in that particular case, it turned out to be a misunderstanding. But even so, the proposition in some ways is quite good. It's certainly far better than actually delivering something to a publisher. If you want to deliver a game, for example, you're only getting 15% of the retail price, and the other 85% goes to the publisher and to the wholesaler and to the retailers. So from some perspectives, it's quite a good deal, getting 70% of the sales price after tax of a particular product and paying a relatively small amount. Then the only concern seemed to be this business of transparency. So what actions are needed to keep gatekeeping under control? I think regulation, as I've pointed out before, well, I think the aim of what we're doing is pluralism and diversity of supply. Let the market provide. If there genuinely is variety out there, To a large extent, the market can do quite well in certainly in big markets, not necessarily in small markets. And then perhaps a judicious combination of carrots and sticks. Carrots, inducements to do the right thing, coupled with, you know, corporate social responsibility, and sticks in the form of quite substantial sanctions if people are found to be cheating, found to be doing something else. When it comes to editorial issues, coming from the northern part of Europe, I would still like to see people exhaust self-regulatory mechanisms first. So getting, say, something like a press council or somebody else to have a look at complaints rather than having a government body to do that. And then looking, if that doesn't work out, on antitrust or competition law and fair trading legislation. Sometimes it's not just competition, it's just fair trading provisions. Things are being misrepresented. We see that in Hong Kong at Prince Edward Station. You know, there was an article on Sunday in the Sunday Morning Post about online traders and the fact that there are crowds in stations actually checking their goods before handing over their cash because they don't necessarily believe they're going to get the goods that they've actually seen advertised online. So regulation is clearly one area, but that depends very much on national and regional circumstances. I think a second area is investigative journalism and academic research. They often go hand in hand. Certainly in an area like Hong Kong, I think you've still got pretty free press and press who can be relied on digging out things if they're not too clean. You've still got a legal system that seems to be working pretty well, and you've got good academics. So a combination of all these things would probably work quite well here, perhaps not quite so well a few hundred kilometres further north of us. And I think the priority is looking at some of these new areas. There are lots of new business models in the digital world. They may be completely unfamiliar to most people. A familiarity with how things actually work from a commercial perspective, not just a legal one, can be a useful counterbalance to make sure that people aren't being fobbed off with something they shouldn't be. And then I'm still a firm believer in the role of education. So I think that when it comes to even primary schools, getting kids to do things, getting kids not just to express themselves through the written word and through paintings, but also orally through making videos and so on, is an incredibly important thing, and it's a way of actually making sure that they end up thinking about some of the ethical dimensions of these work processes. After all, my granddaughter's age 7 and 10, if we leave our mobile phone on the table when I'm at home, they come back and they've reprogrammed them, added videos, so when you pick it up, you'll start playing back a video of them singing some particular pop song or something of that kind. So we're in a general, we've got these digital natives. Just about anybody who has been born in the last 20 years is a digital native, certainly in the industrialized world. And the rest of us are sort of digital immigrants. We're just coming to terms with those. But those have been brought up with digital technologies along with their mother's milk. So in that particular case, it's a question of actually creating activities where we can try things out, do things, discuss them, and look at some of the look at the broader picture, some of the implications of what it is we're doing.